Good afternoon, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into yet another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler. Our first guests today are featured tomorrow night at a new salon at the launch pad. Wait a minute. Salon at the launch pad? That's right. The salon has now taken residence at the launch pad. And here to tell us about it are the curator of the salon series, Alya Howe. Welcome.
Thank you, Luke.
Also here is Stefano Dufresne, one of the featured performers tomorrow night. Stefano, welcome back.
Thank you, Luke. Glad to be back.
Also here is Sarah Graff on the cello, who is also featured tomorrow night at the launch pad. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Launchpad, salon. Tell me more.
Well, our salon up at Justice Snows has had a five-year run, and after 5 years, our underwriter, pockets became a little shallower and couldn't continue underwriting it. And so I was tossed up in the air with this series, and Andrea and I, who I co-curate the series, were wondering, well, what do we do? And Amy Kimberly of Carbondale Arts beautifully invited us to come and perform at the launch pad. And we're not underwritten here, so this is a leap of faith. We are relying on ticket sales.
Okay.
But it's a fantastic house. And for years, we have wanted to do an up valley, down valley salon, because we've discovered that the audience actually don't often travel from one community to the other. I have to say, Carbondalians travel better than the Aspenites coming down. So my dream, Luke, is really to build a performing arts circuit for our mountain towns, not only the salon series, the writ large series, the poetry brothel, and anyone else's series who I can help. So this is step one. We have two places now. We have the launch pad, and the Wheeler Opera House's adopted us in their sunset sessions.
I saw that. So you're at the launch pad tomorrow night and the next night at the Wheeler.
Yes, a slightly different lineup, but it's killer, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm really stoked.
Yeah. Now, is that in the lobby where the bar is?
Yes.
Or is it on the main stage?
No, it's okay. In the lobby. And we're talking about bringing the salon to the main stage for our 5th year anniversary. But that's a little ways down the line.
Sure.
Back to tomorrow.
Well, I love that dream. You know, maybe what you ought to consider is taking that to all the various opera houses around Colorado.
Okay.
There's a lot of them.
That's
and
true.
Some of them kind of out of the way and really funky and cool.
Thank you, Luke. Thanks.
Yeah.
Great idea.
Yeah, try that one. So tell me about this one. What's the thread between all of your future performers?
I don't know that there is a thread in terms of in a salon. What I try and curate, and Andrea, my co-curator up in Aspen, have been trying to create is a balanced series, something that will stimulate and intrigue all of our senses and stretch our ears, our hearts, our minds. And I think we have this nailed in this salon for Carbondale.
Nice. Well, I see you have a jazz drummer starting off.
Yes, that's Zach Ritchie, who's a local. And
yeah.
I chatted with him on the phone and I said, so, yep, you're going to do drumming and stuff, you told me. And any more about it? And he says, yes, I'm going to explore the quarter note. I'm going to keep it simple and show the audience what I have learned and how I play with the quarter note. So he'll hold a steady beat. And he'll introduce us to that, and then he'll start playing on the quarter note and just show us the myriad of things that he does.
Wow.
And so I'm really grateful because I asked him to take us in to what he's been learning. Zach is at CU Boulder. He comes from Carbondale. He was in my daughter's class at the Roaring Fork High School. And he's beginning to not only write his own stuff, but be picked up by some pretty incredible jazz groups out on the Front Range.
I think of jazz drumming, I think of cymbal work. So I wonder if that's what we'll hear. Lots of cymbal work.
I'm not sure, because when I think of MJQ and their brushwork, on the snare drum.
But it's a far different beast than rock and roll drumming.
It definitely is.
Yeah, it's very delicate sometimes and sometimes bombastic, but I wouldn't say it's primitive like rock and roll drumming.
No, I think he'll definitely take us on an intriguing journey of the quarter note.
And it's also cool that he's a local boy, just starting to make his way. I understand he's trying to enter the Denver music scene, which is cool.
I think he is. Nice. He's not trying. I think it's happening.
Oh, he's in there.
Yeah.
Nice. Do you know what groups he's playing?
No, I don't. Okay. But with Zach, I've been listening to him for a while. When I first heard him drumming, he sort of stretched my ears. And I thought, oh, he's listening to something interesting and interpreting it. So he played at the Poetry Brothels a couple of times as a musical poet. And also accompanying the poets. And each poet he accompanied, he listened, he added himself, and he really communicates and has a dialogue with who he's working with. I think he's someone that we'll all be keeping our ears on.
So from jazz drumming to dance after that.
Yeah.
And they're dancing your piece, I understand.
They are dancing an excerpt from my piece, Vacuum, about what you might want to clean out of your life to literally what vacuum do you own. And I've put the solo on a brand new dancer in our valley called Caroline Yates. And she danced in the fashion show. You'll find her teaching over at True Nature and managing the event. She is a gem who has just arrived to our community. So I'm really excited to have the audience, if you've seen Vacuum before, it's a completely different solo on Caroline and her interpretation of it. So
did you change it because she's doing it, or did you give her liberty to change it?
A mixture of the two. Okay. I had a look at Caroline as a dancer, and we began to meet in the solo and stretch it and change it. And that's the beauty of a solo, is that if you have the choreographer around, you have the opportunity to really see what this dancer's expression is of falling in love with a habit, this solo's about. And sometimes our habits in the beginning, we absolutely adore them. And then there's usually a time when we should actually let go of this habit because it no longer serves us. And yet we keep it. So this is about loving your habit and vacuuming it out. And there's a chorus with Jenny Patek, Shannon Jones, and myself dancing in this version of the excerpt from Vacuum.
About that. Is it your habit to learn different things from different performers performing your pieces?
I hope so.
Do you always learn something new when you see it?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to find a new way to communicate, a new way to inspire, a new way to develop the piece so it's honest and authentic to this dancer's voice.
Interesting. And then you have a cello.
My favorite
instrument. It's so resonant. Performed by Sarah Graff. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to Express Yourself.
Hi, thank you.
So are you playing original pieces?
I'm not. I played in a salon about 6 years ago in Aspen.
Our first one,
I think. I think so, the very first one. And in that one, I played with a keyboard. So I played music that was for cello and piano. In this case, it'll be just solo cello. I looked at a lot of different music trying to decide what I wanted to do in 15 minutes because a lot of cello music is much longer than that. And I came back to Bach every time I looked at different things. I thought, no, I just should play Bach. Tomorrow I will also play a short piece by Prokofiev. But today I brought some excerpts from the Bach to share.
Great. So, well, you have your cello, so let's hear it. Thank you. That's lovely.
Thank you.
Bach on a Saturday evening in the summertime. What could be better?
Yes.
Do you remember the first time you played the cello, or do you remember the first time you heard the cello and realized, I want to play that?
Well, I don't remember when I first heard it, but I do remember starting in fifth grade in public school in music class, and I was the only string player. Everybody else was in the band, but somehow I chose the cello, and I don't remember how.
You know, that's kind of an unusual choice for a fifth grader. Most fifth graders, I think, would pick up something loud, like a trumpet or the drums or
guitar.
Something. Guitar. Yeah, there you
right.
go. So that's really cool. And you stayed with it all these years.
I did. Yeah, I played in school all the way through middle school. And then in high school, I really decided to focus on it and then went to conservatory. So I've been able to continue playing out here, and I'm really glad that I can basically make a living doing this.
Yeah, and you were here, I don't know, a couple months ago, weren't you, before your Steve's Guitars gig?
Right, with the Sopris Trio.
Yeah, how did that go?
It was great. We had
was
a great
it?
Showing. Yeah.
Nice. And so Bach tomorrow also, or some other pieces?
Tomorrow I'll play Bach, the one that I just played, but also some other ones, and then a short march by Prokofiev.
Great. That sounds great. Sarah Graff playing live here at KDNK. And tomorrow night at the Salon over at the Launch Pad, what time do things get going, Elia?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
Is when we start. So house opens at 5. The art gallery will be open. There's an incredible exhibit over there called Correspondence. So come early, browse the gallery, and pick a good seat.
Well, also with us is filmmaker and actor Stefano Defray from New York City, although just recently arrived from Europe, I understand.
Yes, I just came back from the Cannes Film Festival. Glad to be here, Luke.
Glad to
be part of this Salon with Alia. Curates it very, very well, and I'm just honored and humbled.
Were you a participant at the Cannes Festival?
So our film was accepted to the Cannes Film Festival.
Wow.
And it premiered on the 25th of May and the 26th, and I found out on the 27th that we came in third place in our category. And a nice little interesting story with the town of Carbondale is that the editor for the film is Krisha Carter Gez, who was an editor who lives here, a local editor, worked with the BBC as an Emmy award-winning editor, and Alia had put me in touch with her early on in the project, and when she knew that I was filming, and I was just excited to present this film here in the Valley. Glad to be here with you guys.
So the film you're presenting tomorrow night is the same one that just got the third place?
Correct.
Oh, tell me about it.
So the film is called Tu me manques, which literally translates to You Are Missing From Me. It's a story about three women who are tied by one central theme. These women never meet, but you see them affected by the same central theme, and you see how it affects each of their lives. It cuts from one story to another, and then back to one specific girl and then another one. It's a film, you know, I have not, so I spent most of my life direct acting the past 10 years, and this film I wrote and directed because I was very sick last year. So it came out of a very vulnerable place inside of me to want to create something when I knew that I was not well, and I thought I should do something different. I should try something outside of my comfort zone, and I had been in over, you know, 35 movies and TV shows, and I thought you develop your own sensibilities, your own tastes, the things that you want to see. I was very interested in doing a story about women, a story about three different women, a story about them becoming heroes at the end of the story, and their courage. And I don't think that I would have ever made this movie if I wasn't sick. And so it's a silver lining for me.
Huh. So yeah. There's a little poignancy there, it sounds like.
Yeah. It makes everything a little bit closer, a little bit more dangerous, more riskier for yourself. You're showing more of the things that you're not so comfortable showing. And I don't ever know if it's good or bad. You can just try to, you know, be as authentic with it as possible.
Huh.
But I'm very honored to be here in the Valley, and I'm so lucky. You know, I was looking through this whole program and the musicians. I saw Sarah in the hallway, and I thought I should have brought. she's coming with a cello. I don't have a musical instrument. I got nothing. So I'm very honored to be part of this program, and I love doing the salons. Really, I really do.
Why?
Because I see so many different artists, and a lot of times they do a different medium of what I am, what's in my wheelhouse, what I'm comfortable in. And I always think, God, these people are so talented. It makes me feel very humble, and I go, wow, I'm part of this, you know, this group. I feel I learned something about them. I see how good they are in their specific field.
So it's inspiring.
Very inspiring. Very, very, very inspiring. Mm-hmm. And it's also a very nice kind of evening to go through, because you don't get stuck on one specific kind of, yeah. you know, it's not one specific type of music or one specific type of poetry reading or one specific type of a comedy, or, you know, it's a full evening. And I really encourage people from Carbondale to come out, whoever's listening, 6 to 8 tomorrow at the launch pad. I would love to see you and talk to you if you're there, and I'm sure all the artists feel the same way.
Well, you know, the blurb I read about this one says that the reason it's so effective is, let me read it here. The inspirational impact comes from the close connection between the artist and the audience. And the two salons I've seen definitely bear that out. But I would say that part of the power of the thing, too, is what you just mentioned. The fact that it's a very varied program. And you're not going to get a varied program like that, really, anywhere else in the Valley.
No.
No, and it's very consciously curated, Luke, so that it's like 5-star dining on the performing arts, that you get these exquisite tastes in the art form. And it's not distant, it's very intimate. In the intermission, at the end, the audience and artists chat to one another. The artists chat to one another. New connections are made. Collaborations occur. It's just a moment of magic. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, too.
Just to add on to that idea, there's a poet that I saw the first time that I was ever part of the salon. I saw Rosemary.
Trummer,
yes. Thank you for the last name. Rosemary, an amazing poet. And I remember having dinner with her and drinks afterwards. And still to this day, still keep a connection with her. And that's all because of being part of it, and how it was curated by Alia. So she really does a very strong, intentional job of how it comes together and weaves in. And I still keep in touch with her, you know, over the years, and see what she's doing. Yeah.
So tickets still at Eventbrite? Are you doing it still that way?
The tickets will close at 6 o'clock tonight at Eventbrite, and then it's first come, first served on the door. So if you want to purchase at the door, we don't have credit card taking facilities, so it's $23 cash or check, and come a little early so you make sure you can get in.
That's great. Alia Howe, welcome back, and thank you.
Thank you, Luke.
And
tons.
Good luck to
thank
you.
Thank you.
Sarah Graff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Stefano Dufresne.
Blessings to you, Luke.
Same
blessings,
to
my
you.
Man.
Okay, stay with us. Chris Bank up next on Express Yourself. Well, for 32 years, Roaring Fork Valley residents have enjoyed music every hump day evening in Two Rivers Park during the summer. And this year is no exception. The Glenwood Summer of Music returns, despite the troubles of its sponsoring organization. And here to tell us more is the Leonine, Chris Bank.
Wow.
Well, you know, I've got pretty good hair, Chris, but I've always been jealous of yours.
You know, you just got all yours down here.
So you've got a hell of a lineup this year, my man.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, we always start every year that we've, since this is our seventh year, and every year that we've done it, we've started with the students from Jazz Aspen summer camps. And that's always... it's a lot bigger than what people understand. It's usually about an 18-piece band playing some great, you know, like Stevie Wonder tunes and Pat Metheny. I mean, just all over the place.
Nice.
And great energy. They work on it for like 8 days, and they're joined by six college students that help them out for the last 3 days. So that's always a great opener. And this year, I almost just picked this band on the name alone.
You know, Joe Smith and the Spicy Pickles.
You got to like that name.
That is a pretty good name. Yeah. With Jesse Carolina.
Yeah.
Tell me about them.
Well, they're out of Denver, and they play a lot at the Mercury Cafe, do a lot of their swing nights, you know, swing dancing. So it's a toe-tapping band with three horns, and they've got a great vocalist. So it should just be a good, like I say, a toe-tapping, head-bopping kind of night.
Nice. Jazz.
It's jazz. It's swing, and it's just up-tempo fun stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And then that's June 28th. So
that is. That's coming right
two
up.
2 weeks from now, right?
Yeah, less than two.
Nice. Yeah. Taylor Scott coming after that.
No,
I've got that wrong.
Battle of Santiago.
Somebody was telling me about this band.
Oh, they were.
I guess I have to hear them. Tell me more. It sounds very intriguing.
Well, they're out of Toronto, and they just happen to be going through, and I believe they're, where is the series now? Over in Ridgeway?
Oh, yeah.
The Thursday night?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Dave Miller turned me on to them, said they're coming through. He said, you got to hear these guys. It's a Afro-Cuban, but it's not all traditional. It's more modern with their own twist on it and a lot of fire.
Big band?
Well, what have I got in that picture?
Three, four, six, eight. That's a
pretty
big
good
band.
Size.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's not like we've had a lot of Cuban bands up in the 14, 15 members. Not quite that, but this is good horns and a lot of percussion.
Gotta love that cha-cha-cha. And then Nanama opening, which is a new band in the valley. And I know that they've been here at KD&K a couple times already.
Oh, yeah.
And they played at the Glenwood Center for the Arts benefit last week.
At the Vaudeville, yeah.
Yeah.
So this was initially going to be their coming out and record release. And then the benefit came up, so they had a little warm-up.
Mm-hmm.
And... They're doing really good stuff.
Yes, I agree completely. And the Major and the Mombacks, although I think they've changed their
name.
They
did. Super Doppler. I just got that a week ago.
I did too, and that's because they have a brand new CD, which KD&K received a few weeks ago. And then there was an email from their manager saying, they're not Major and the Mombacks anymore.
No.
So describe them for me, if you would.
What's their description? That's a younger band that is just it's a happy band, you know. They've got a couple horns and they're just it's like everything you see of them. They're just having fun all the time.
Mm-hmm. Looks, Southern rock. Mm, I know they're from Virginia. Norfolk.
They're from Virginia, but I wouldn't put them as Southern rock. It's a little more. It's one of those kind of defies the.
You gotta love those kind, don't you?
With a name like that, I mean, and now the Super Dopplers.
Super Dopplers.
You know,
the Super Dopplers.
How do you say that?
I don't, you know? I'm not so sure about that name, but that's not my affair.
It's not
Super
ours.
Dopplers, otherwise known as Major and the Mombacks, with Whiskey Stomp opening.
Right. And I have to admit, I don't know a lot about it. The committee came up with Whiskey Stomp, and I have yet to hear them. So I wouldn't step out too far. But everybody that talked about them said, oh, yeah, that's great. You got to get these guys. So I'm kind of, I haven't had a chance to get out and hear them play. But I'm going on the word of, we got a pretty strong committee that, you know, when they say that they got something, we do pretty good with that.
Nice. Taylor Scott after that, the Wednesday after that, with Louie and the Lizards opening, Taylor Scott, soul, blues, funk, rock.
We all know Louie.
Yes, we do.
Our very own geek.
Yeah.
Is he still doing the geek?
He is.
Yeah. Well, Taylor Scott came up here a couple years ago with Otis Taylor.
Oh. And playing in Otis's band.
Yeah, he's a smoking guitarist. And I don't know, for me, almost stole the show. You know, they did about four songs without Otis, and he was the show.
Uh-huh.
And then since then, I've kind of followed some of the stuff that I've seen of theirs, and they want, you know, every year they ask if there's any possibility, and we said, yeah, this is the year. This is your year to come up and show us what you got.
And then the series closing out with two great acts. The first one on the 26th, the Black Lilies. They played Mountain Fair last year and just knocked everybody dead.
I wasn't at that one. I heard that. And our committee has been trying to get Black Lilies for years.
Yeah, yeah.
So we lucked out. And that was another one that was coming through. And it's one of those.
That's why it's really great that you're midweek. Because, you know, a lot of bands can't often count on a midweek gig. So that's pretty convenient for them.
Yeah. So, you know, and it's great that Paoni has the Thursday follow up. I think I said Dave Miller. I think it's Rob Miller. But that's been really nice to have that connection there and get a few bands through that.
Mm-hmm. And also passing through to cap it all off, this is a coup, Peter Rowan.
Major coup. Yeah.
Yeah, is he playing solo or is he bringing a
band?
Well,
the opening act has been his backup band.
Oh.
And
The Wooks.
And so they're very familiar with his stuff and vice versa. He'll play probably a handful of solo songs to start his set, and then they'll join him.
Uh-huh.
And that should be a pretty powerful experience.
I would say
Peter
so.
Peter Rowan with a five. I've never seen him anything but solo.
And oh, how about that?
He's pretty strong.
Now, is this pretty straight up bluegrass, or is it the other side of Peter Rowan, the real adventurous?
I would have to say, how do we know?
I guess
who's going to show up?
Yeah,
you know, Peter Rowan, he's gone through a lot of transformations.
Yes, he has.
He's a very entertaining guy in between songs, and he's a storyteller. He's who knows what he's been doing.
And he's been doing it for more than 50 years, so you know he's got it down.
He's got it down.
Peter Rowan, that's a real exciting one right
there. We missed an opening act on the Black Lilies, Colin Reese.
Oh.
A guitarist he's living in Grand Junction now, but he's out of D.C. And just some really, really, he's going to be solo with with his own tracks that he put together. And some sweet, sweet stuff that he's putting out. So it'd be kind of different opening for the Black Lilies. He's kind of more in a kind of a soulful R&B fusion sort of thing.
Nice. Yeah. What a great lineup, Chris. You knocked it out of the park this year for sure. And I understand that we should probably thank the city of Glenwood for rescuing this series. Is that right?
Yeah. It's been a fairly smooth transition. You know,
that's great.
Things that have to be done when you do that, but I think it's all going to be worth it. And, you know, hopefully people then just read the headline and go, well, maybe it's not happening. We're definitely happening. And the city of Glenwood didn't want to see this go away. And a lot of people didn't want to see it go away. So we could still use some help fundraising because that did set us back a little.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still a little bit behind on that. So anybody that can help out in that way certainly would be appreciated.
Well, like I said, you're holding down Wednesdays for three decades. You know, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, 2.5 with the noons, and we're going into 7 now. So.
Yep, pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should go out with a little bit of Peter Rowan. How about that? Chris, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me, Luke.
All right, stay with us. There is more to come. Here is Peter Rowan. All right, it is 4:35. You're tuned to the Express Yourself show. And Shelley Stevenson's play, The Memory of Water, debuted in 1995, and The Guardian called it larger than life and slightly knockabout, spiced with enough weed and whiskey to draw out both laughs and recriminations. But Stevenson spins a delicate treatise on human nature with gentleness and precision. I spoke with the director and a couple of the actors of the Thunder River Theater's new production of The Memory of Water, which opens tonight. Joining the program now is the director of the upcoming Thunder River Theater production of Memory of Water, Sue Lavin. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also here is Jennifer Johnson, one of the cast members. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Luke.
And Will Bledsoe is here, too. Hi, Will.
Hello, Luke.
Tell me about the story. What's the story of The Memory of Water?
It is a delightfully complicated story, actually. But simply put, it is three sisters who are home for their mother's funeral and the delicate balance of their relationship and their relationships with their significant others and their relationship with their mother and the nature of our memories of our childhood and how they sometimes differ from our siblings' remembrances of the same things.
And they are all brought together because their mother just died.
Yes, okay. Of Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, which is interesting in light of the name of the play.
Yes, exactly.
Is it correct to assume that one of the overriding themes of the play is memory?
Absolutely.
Yeah, how does that pan out, for instance, Jennifer, in your character?
In several ways. There are several instances throughout the play where my character is a doctor, and she actually has a patient who has amnesia because he got hit on the head by a jar of pickled bell peppers, and he has lost his memory. And so she's in a relationship with Will's character, and there are times that the two doctors are discussing the memory of this patient, discussing with the sisters different ways that they remember moments in their childhood differently, how they've kind of appropriated one another's memories as their own. And kind of the different tone that can be taken from each of these past memories based on what your experience was of it.
And does this happen all at once in a great crashing revelation, or is it bit by bit?
Bit by bit.
Is it?
And a few spikes of revelation.
Interesting. Yeah. Sue, I wonder if this particular production has presented challenges that have really engaged you this time around.
Absolutely.
Tell me.
It's a very interesting combination of characters. The characters are all in contrast to each other. Though the three sisters are related by genes, they don't have too much else in common. And there's a lot of tension at this moment, as anyone who has experienced the death of a loved one would know, you know, those moments when the family gathers in a stressful crisis can be tough on the relationships, you know, and so there's moments of great tension, and they're in a way struggling to find how they're each going to deal with, reconcile the death of the mother and also reconcile their own relationships. And in the meantime, there are the two significant others, and both of those relationships have quite a bit of tension that are in crisis at this moment as well.
I assume, Will, you are one of those significant others.
I'm one of the crises, yes.
And what do you do to resolve that crisis?
I try to hide my head under the covers and stay out of the melee. the two male characters also have their the things that they are facing that cause them to reflect on change. For example, one character, the other male in the show, Gerald, doesn't want to continue to do what he's doing work-wise, and he's runs a business with his wife, and my change is my wife has MS. Yeah, well, who is not Jennifer. Jennifer is my girlfriend, and so I've got this double life, and that's the tension inside this character, and he's trying to resolve that as well. So, yeah.
So between Alzheimer's and MS, there's a lot going on.
That's only the medical stuff that's going on.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there's a very scientific thing that I find interesting. The Memory of Water, the title of the play, is actually a phenomenon. There's now in science, water research is really interesting and ongoing in many of the countries of the world and not just the Western world, because the scientific research has found that water has memory and it remembers the places that it's been. So one of the experiments that was very interesting in this respect was a bunch of people were put in the room of a scientist and they were given a dropper and they each put their drops of water from the same source on a slide. And when they did slides of the water, all of the water was different, as if it was affected by the person who was holding the dropper, even though that person did not ever touch the water.
That's really interesting. How does that dynamic manifest in this play?
Well, Will has a big part about memory of water, but this playwright, Sheila Stevenson, always has a scientific phenomenon in her plays. She's just a playwright who's interested in science. And I would say that I would love their opinion too, but what I see as director is that, like water, each of us is deeply affected by the other contacts we have, whether we claim them or not. You know, sometimes these sisters are ready to literally kill each other, but they're deeply affected by each other. And in a sense, all human beings are deeply affected by all other human beings with whom they're in contact. And the ones you're most intimate with, you are affected in ways that are not always on the surface.
I think one of the questions of the play is it possible to escape your memory?
Yeah.
Is it possible to resolve your memory? And I know that just from an outsider's perspective, watching the other actors in the play, you know, we all have memories, and it's just a question of how much influence our memories have and how do we process that so that we can be happy. Can we ever really escape memories and things that happened in our past? And what are we going to do with that moving forward? One of the things that's really beautiful about the play is that when you first look at these three female characters, these sisters, the question I had was how they don't appear to have grown up in the same household. They're so radically different. Mm-hmm. And yet in this process of coming together, they're more of a family at the end of the play than they possibly ever would have been. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how water seeks its own balance. And in essence, these three women have found, like water, a type of balance in their own relationships.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just having a sister myself, when we're away from one another, we're nothing like each other. Absolutely nothing like each other. We don't look like each other. We've got completely different facial characteristics of our parents. When we come together as a family, that's when we start kind of falling back into the rhythm of who we were when we were kids. And we argue the same way we argued when we were kids, and we fight the way we did, and we laugh at the same silly things, and we tease each other about the inaccuracies of our memories in our own experience, in our own family. And I think it's really, it's interesting that you note that, because that's one of the things I love that I think is so honest about this play, is that when the three of them come back together, they are who they are out in the world, and they slowly become who they are as sisters throughout the course of the play. And so their relationships and their dynamics shift throughout the course of the play, and she wrote it really beautifully to reflect that.
So there's a development arc for mm-hmm. those sisters inside yeah. the play.
And it's only a 24-hour span of time. that's covered in the play. Huh. It's only just this day before the funeral.
I was interested in what Will said because I think, you know, there's a few lines in the play. One of the lines that Jennifer's character, Mary, has is, what are you without your memory? And it's a really interesting question.
Who are you?
Who are you? And then there's another line in the play that the mother says, which is she quotes something from one of Jennifer's, from one of Mary's medical books. And it says, we use memory. Human beings are the only ones who use memory for their own survival. Hmm. And so, yes, the memories of siblings are different than yours because you needed a different set of memories to survive. In fact, my sister told me a story last time I was with my family, and I played a leading role in this story. I do not have one iota of memory of it. Yeah. It's as if it didn't happen to me. It only happened to her. And I'm like, where did it go? Why don't I remember it? And it was an important thing. Yeah.
Kept in there. I've had that exact same experience with my sister, and she'll be talking about something in vivid detail. And I'm fascinated. I'm like, you are making this up. And she's like, I'm not. We were here. It smelled like this. You were wearing this. I mean, it's crisp and clear and true for her. And I have no recollection of it whatsoever. I think that's completely that's an amazing statement that you remember the things that you need to remember. And those are the things that create who we are.
And there is a sense of survival in this play. You know, the survival of the relationships is challenged. The survival of the relationship of the sisters is challenged. The future survival without their mother is challenged. There's a lot being asked of how we move forward when we have loss. And then when one of our parents dies, all the memories of family get shifted because they were the repository, and now the repository is gone. So,
Did the mother, what's her name, Vi?
Vi.
Did Vi give her daughters the tools to understand that,
No.
They're discovering this along
in
the way.
In fact, they are fascinated that they survived. Like they actually make jokes about it. One of the lines that I have in the show is, it's amazing that she gave birth to three daughters and sent us out into the world so ill-equipped. I mean, that's just how we see her and how we think of her. And later in the show, she says, I was always your mother, always to blame. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that we do to our parents. We shift the blame for everything that went wrong in our childhood to them and everything that went right in our childhood to them. When they were just now at the age that they were, where we were doing this to them, they were just people. They were fallible. And they have to live with the memories of us, you know, our pouting and our crying and their patience that they had with us. She says, I had years of patience with you. And you just look at me as if, you know, you're just annoyed with me. And so many of the things that she says are things that my mother could say directly to me. And I get hit in the chest in those moments. I'm always calling my mom on my way home from rehearsal. I love you. Wow. Can you come see this?
So does that experience inform the way you approach this character?
Absolutely. 100%. The character of Mary, when I read the script, I was a little startled at how similar she is to me. Except for the fact that I'm a theater teacher and she's a doctor. There's a pretty major difference, but a lot of similarities. My father actually has frontal temporal dementia, and my sister has moved home to take care of him and care for him. And so one of the sisters in the play, Teresa, who's the middle sister, she has moved in with Vi. And it has been taking care of her and has taken care of everything. And so Mary and Catherine, the other two sisters, have been able to have their lives pretty much uninterrupted where there's been this major stoppage in Teresa's life. And she really, it's important to her character that she communicates how powerfully her life has been impacted by this, and we don't want to hear it. And I think about that when I'm speaking to my sister in the last few months, like how deeply my sister's life has been impacted by her being there to take care of my parents when I can't. And yeah, there's several uncomfortable parallels for me in this. It makes me really want to see my family.
Well, you know, family dynamics, three siblings. I'm thinking the oldest sibling correct me if I'm wrong for purposes of this play, oldest sibling, uber responsible, taking care of everybody. The youngest one has permission to be Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The middle one, somewhere in the middle. Is that kind of the range in this play too?
Almost. I would say the super responsible one is Teresa. She's almost OCD. And Mary is super, the oldest one is super responsible in her profession. So she does amazing things in her profession. Plus, she's interested in research. Both the doctors are, and that's one of their attractions to each other.
I think it's also interesting that with the three sisters, you see kind of an evolution of women's participation in the world. Because when you look at Catherine, the youngest, she's flighty, she's irresponsible, she's entitled. You know, that kind of represents a lot of our youth these days, right? Or maybe youth in general. Mary's character, you know, Mary's character is the character that goes out there and functions in a predominantly male world. She's a scientist, she's a doctor, and she's very successful. And Teresa is kind of that borderline character where she's doing both. She's maintaining sort of the domestic duties and responsibilities of family, and at the same time, you know, she has her life as a business owner.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting for me to look at those three stages. You know, the other thing that's interesting, too, is that because my mother passed on of Alzheimer's a few years back, and her memory starts to retract. In other words, the person advances in Alzheimer's, then what they remember and what they're able to sort of sense in their environment retracts closer and closer and closer to the body. And there's a beautiful line at the end of the play where Vi says, it's time for me to go. And she talks about the holes in her brain, and she talks about sort of the dissolution, which is, again, a water-based term, the dissolution of her memory and not knowing who she is and not knowing what it all means and what reality is. And then she finally reaches the point where she says, it's time now for me to go. I think so.
Yeah.
And it's a really poignant moment in the play.
Yeah. The moment for me that is – I'm sorry, Luke. The moment
that's all right.
for me that's like that is she has this line where she says, but sometimes the pieces would drift together and float to the surface, and I was still there, still me, I'm still here. And even quoting it now, I can't get through it when she says it. It makes me cry because I think about the beautiful mind that she's talking about, and I think about the beautiful mind that your mother had, that my father has, and the pieces of those floating back together and giving them those moments of clarity. And again, in a yes. water-based kind of analogy that they're using, and it's so beautifully and powerfully written. It's
fluid and choppy at the same time.
Yeah, it just stops you in your tracks. It's...
Now, I understand that Vi makes visitations of her daughters during
she
the
does.
Play. How
she
do
does.
You handle that? How does it, first, how is it staged? How does it impact the character?
We can't tell you about the staging. You got to go see it because it's a wonder.
There we go.
You'll know that she's not 100% feet on the ground, let's
yeah.
say.
Yeah, but, and a shout out to Sean Jeffries, who's lighting and,
yes.
and has set designed the show really beautifully and really thoughtfully. And just the reflections of water and of the breaking of the memory just within the set are really just beautiful, just beautifully done. He's done a really glorious job. But the lighting is a big part of what separates Vi from reality a little bit. And we never... You know, and I wouldn't say never. I'd say it's up to the audience member to decide whether or not they think she's a ghost or Mary's memory of her or what she is or where she's coming from, if she's a manifestation of some subconscious guilt that Mary feels or if she's actually visiting her. And that's there's never a real, you know, specific determination of that specifically given. Like, we've made choices. Meredith Daniel, who's playing Vi, she and I have made some pretty specific choices and talking to Sue about it. But it's really for the audience to decide.
I think that's one of the beautiful things about this play is that it doesn't answer any questions.
Yeah.
It provokes more questions and it kind of will force the audience to – it's going to kind of destabilize.
Yeah.
And it's going to force the audience to think about these issues
yeah.
that get evoked and then come to their own resolution or not.
Or not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even within the relationships. I mean, mm-hmm. you're left. It's there, a lot of things are brought up and finally said, but not resolved.
Right.
A lot of moments happen in the show that are like, wow, this moment in this relationship. This is a huge moment in this relationship. And then it gets interrupted. and you don't get the
it dissolves
the, necessarily the resolution to all of those moments. And it's beautiful what it just brings up.
Yeah.
And just lets you kind of.
And Sue has made sure that our pace is quick, so it's not a slow-moving play.
It's not a slow-moving
you
play.
You've got to really sit on the edge of your seat and pay attention.
Pay attention.
Because everything that's being said is just so damn smart. It's like, what? What did they say?
You have to come see it more than once is really what we're saying.
Yeah.
You're going to have to make
the, our listeners have to make sure to to put aside two nights.
Do you know what's really? Do you know what's funny about that? I always, at for Thunder River shows, I always go to opening night and closing night. Because they're two entirely different shows.
Oh, interesting.
Because they happen 3 weeks apart from each other and or 2.5 weeks apart from each other. And the, all the growth that happens in that really large span of time and the things that happen to the people playing the characters and just the weather changing. I don't know what it is, but I there's such a noticeable difference between opening and closing night. I always buy my opening and closing night tickets for TRTC shows because we have the 3 weekends and that's my pitch.
Oh, that's cool. You know, family dynamics are endlessly fascinating and certainly fodder for drama, but I wouldn't necessarily think of, I wouldn't necessarily link comedy with that. So that's kind of interesting.
It's that same kind of comedy that happens at a funeral. It's that we have to break the, it's tension breaking, inappropriate, just...
Kind of raw bone, things get said that wouldn't get said at any other time.
Making jokes about the coffin and making jokes about drinking and making jokes about inappropriate behavior and just silliness. Just those things, those moments of levity that keep us from going crazy or keep us from breaking down crying. It's like she peppered in a lot of those and they're fun to play.
So that makes those sisters' roles incredibly juicy.
Yeah, they really,
yeah, I'd like to say a word about that because right now, statistically, in plays, only 27% of plays have female leads and have strong female characters. So even though the world is changing in terms of women taking more and more responsibility, that really hasn't happened in the world of playwriting.
True.
There haven't been opportunities for female playwrights and there haven't been opportunities for actors who are women. And in any way equal to the opportunities that men have. Shakespeare would be an example because he has plays with one great female role like Lady Macbeth and everybody else is male, you know. So I think that one of my attractions to the piece was just to try to balance the scales a little bit. And we love having the two significant others too because those scales really can't be balanced without men and without those relationships too. But it's a different paradigm that you're seeing in theater, not just the male star. And, you know, almost any season anywhere, if you look at the male-female balance, it's way off. So
and it's a female playwright it's being directed by a woman.
Yeah, so it's a big commitment from Thunder River Theater, which I really appreciate. And I will honestly say I've worked pretty hard to remind everyone that this is an important thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, to what plays we choose to do say something about our lives, you know. And I think that young women and young men, this is a good play for them to see too.
Yes, and I would say that the two male characters in this play are unique in that they are also vulnerable, that they also are going through change, and yet at the same time, they're doing what they can to support the women in the play, which is sort of a new persona for men.
Yeah, I think the whole way that the women and men and their relationships is presented is really unique.
Yep.
That alone.
Yeah.
Is worth seeing the play for.